Thank you, John. Hey, thank you. My name is Howard Poland, and I'm an alcoholic. Opinion. But it is true for the newcomers that speakers and Alcoholics Anonymous just share their opinions, their experience, strengths, and hope. They are not authorities. The primary authority on alcoholism from an AA point of view is in the book. Hold the book up. And the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. Our primary description of our program of recovery is in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. Recognizing as a speaker that I'm not an authority, I make up stuff and say that it's in the big book in order to add credibility to my talk. The reason the book is over there is because I make up page numbers. And I say, it says thus and so on page so and so, and nobody ever checks until now. Anyway, I'm glad to be here. Happy birthday to the birthday people, and most welcome to the newcomers. It's great to have you here. My sponsor says, and I believe that it's true, that you keep coming here. You just keep coming here, and your life will get relentlessly better. Just as sure as over any considerable period of time, my life got worse, never better, when I was drinking, my life has gotten relentlessly better since I've come to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have a great life. I'm really excited about my life. I don't want anybody else's life or anybody else's wife. Don't want anybody else's sponsor. Things just worked out really good for me. And I know that it worked out good for me because of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. In the big book, on page 45, it describes our problem as being a lack of power. And that can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. But one of the things that it means to me is that I lacked the power before I came to AA to feel good in and of myself. I lacked the power to see goodness in my life. In retrospect, I have seen that in the worst periods of my life, there was goodness, but there was no chance of me knowing that because I didn't feel good and I couldn't see good. And I'm a native of Los Angeles, but I also, as some of you know, I frequently look at my watch in order to give those of you that worry about whether or not I'm going to stop on time a feeling of optimism. Those of you that know me know that I can't even tell time. I'm a native of Los Angeles, but I was raised in a little farm community near Wichita, Kansas. And when I was a kid, I saw a movie about rounding up wild elephants in India and how they were trained. And they took their already tamed elephants out and rounded up all these wild elephants. Then they sorted the baby elephants out, and they started their training by putting a chain around their right front leg and the other end of the chain around the tree. And the baby elephant fought the chain and fought the chain and fought the chain until the experience of not being able to get loose taught it to believe that it's futile to fight the chain. I don't think intellectually it learned that, but experientially it learned that. And so it stopped fighting the chain. And the trainer went on with the training, but for the rest of the elephant's life, in order to hold it, they would drive a relatively short stake deep enough in the ground that when they put the chain over the short stake, the other end would get tight on the elephant's leg. And just a little tug on his leg would remind the belief that had been imposed on him when he was a baby that it's futile to pull when the chain is tight. And he couldn't pull against the chain. He was certainly strong enough to pull the stake up and walk away, but his mind wouldn't let him do that. I don't think he knew that he couldn't do that, but it nevertheless held him. And when I was in Alcoholics Anonymous about a year, something happened to cause me to remember that story and for me to see that I came to Alcoholics Anonymous with about 1,800,302, roughly, baby elephant beliefs just like that. Some stuff that was never true, some stuff that may have been true when I was 4 or 5 years old but was no longer true when I was 14 or 15, but I didn't even know I knew most of this stuff. For example, one of the first baby elephant beliefs I had was I believed it was important to be right. Very important to be right. Of course, I wouldn't have believed anything that wasn't right. So anything I believed was right, and if you didn't agree with it, you were wrong. And I didn't have to examine that. I just knew it. And another thing I believed, and I don't know, I think I was taught this some way, was that God was a man-like being, an anthropomorphic being, who had created the heaven and earth much the way somehow I saw it, as I would create a snowball and throw it out into the universe. God had created everything that he created and just flung it out there, and there it was going. And God was up in heaven, separated from all of this, and behind the streets, behind the pearly gates, and I was out here pretty much on my own with a bunch of restrictions about how to behave. And one of the other things that I believed was if I could just behave right, I wouldn't be in so much trouble because I was in trouble. I was always in trouble. I always felt like I was in trouble, and I was in trouble. I was in trouble on an ongoing basis. And if I'm not in trouble right now, I'm going to be in trouble in just a little bit. The big book talks about feelings of impending calamity. You know, I was in a state of low-grade alert all my life about, you know, what the hell's going wrong now. And it was always something. I came to believe, I don't know when I came to believe it, but my experience taught me that I'm in trouble. And I always felt in trouble. And when I was 13 years old, I drank bourbon whiskey. And bourbon whiskey solved the trouble. The trouble went away. There was no trouble when I drank whiskey. I had a great feeling of euphoria. The trouble was gone, and I knew that I knew immediately that this is what I have been looking for. This is what I have wanted all the time. And so that was how I kept out of trouble from then on with drinking whiskey. There was a lot of trouble. But I never really saw that the whiskey was causing me trouble. I was in trouble, and the whiskey was helping me go through it, fortunately. I would drink to that. And I got a lot of examples of it. But it is also true. I got a job as an engineer. First I had a job as a process analyst. And part of the job is to analyze processes. And then part of the job connected with that is to write a report on the analysis. The theory being that if you do the analysis and don't write a report, nobody's going to know about it except you. But I didn't understand that concept when I started out. And I didn't know what the hell I was blocked as to what they wanted in the report. I didn't know how to write the damn report. And I finally, I was under pressure, and my boss was going to have somebody help me write reports. So I got all the stuff together, and then this guy had to do something else and left me high and dry. And it was Wednesday. The reports had to be done Friday morning. Wednesday night, I took this stuff home to work on it at home. And I drank about a half a pint. And whatever it was that kept me from knowing what to put in reports went away. The truth is, that this is the honest to God truth, all at once, I got the connection between what you do in the analysis and what should go in the report. All at once, this made sense to me. I had innovative ideas about how to write the report. And I wrote it and took it to work and got it, several of them actually, and got them typed up, got them approved. And my boss came to me and said, I knew you could do it if you just put your mind to it. Now, you know and I know that you can't tell the boss the truth. You got to say, yeah, I know it. But I knew that the reason I was able to do it is because I drank whiskey, and whiskey made me smarter. It didn't just make me feel good. I was more intelligent from drinking whiskey. I really was. And because I drank whiskey and because it helped me with my work, I was promoted from a process analyst to an engineer, to a senior engineer, to a kind of senior engineer, and then an engineering supervisor. Now, during that same period of time, I wrecked 5 cars. I spent a night in the Sharon Springs, Kansas jail, a weekend in the Dodge City County jail, time in the Navy brig, not much, 10 days. That's a long time. 10 minutes is a long time. And so all the time, this is going. I went to a therapist. I went nuts in 1962. I don't know, I wasn't nuts. I was pitiful. I got where I couldn't talk without crying. And I went to... I tried to straighten a dill pickle, and it broke. I went to this guy and I paid him. He lived in San Diego over on, he had an office over near the zoo. And after I'd gone to him for quite a while, he explained to me in convincing detail how my dad was my problem. Well, that was good news for me. Could have been me, but it wasn't. It was my dad. And anyway, I felt good about that. But the point is, a lot of the problems I was having, anybody could see was because I was drinking except me. I could not see that the whiskey was causing me trouble. I think it was in 1972, I drank so much that I damaged my nervous system, so that when I stopped drinking, my nervous system was still damaged, and I could no longer focus my eyes on just one person for very long. I could focus my eyes on one person, but I'd see two of them. I suspect if I had three eyes, I would have seen three of them. That was 3 days after I wasn't drinking anymore, and my right leg wouldn't work. It would work, but it was unreliable. It would... I'd be walking, and then it would just do that, and I'd do a little circle on my way down. My son took me to a doctor, and the doctor said, if you drank, after he checked me out, he said, if you drank, I'd know what was wrong with you. I said, that's not it. On the way home, though, I knew that it was it. And I didn't know if I was going to get well. It was frightening. You know, I was really scared that I had drank, so I'd hurt myself so that I'd never recover. And I, by God, wasn't going to drink again. But in 2 or 3 days, I was just seeing one of each thing. And unless there was two of them, and then I was seeing two. My right leg was working. And I discovered a new belief, which later in AA, I was told was an obsessive belief. And that new belief I discovered was this. Yes, you got in a lot of trouble that weekend when you drank so much. But this time it'll be different. This time you'll control and enjoy it. This time I'll have just enough to get my heart started, get my intelligence going, get that good feeling, and I'm not going to drink anymore. This time it's going to be different. I think the first time it was a little different, and then the second time it was a little more different. And then the third time I had a convulsive seizure. Now that was different. I'd never had that before. If you have had a convulsive seizure, you know that you're hardly aware that it's happening. You're kind of vaguely aware you're jackknifing around there, but it don't bother you much. But it is my experience that it scares hell out of the rest of the family. You know? Just more added pressure. Every time you start to drink, she behaves like a fawn in a forest fire. You know, she don't know what damn way she's going to turn. And goes ballistic. Just adds to my problem. And I already had, you know, I was hopelessly in debt. I simply wasn't making enough money to pay for all of this, and I had an opportunity to sell some equipment that I didn't own. Equipment that I found right before the owner lost it. And I had this other guy who had approached me and said, can you get me some of this kind of test equipment? And I could. And I did. Now, I was not a fast thinker. 10 days after I stole this equipment, with no new information, just dealing with the same information that I had 10 days ago before I stole the equipment, it dawned on me when I woke up in the morning that this equipment had been purchased by the company that I worked for using federal funds, because this was going to be used on a federal contract. and that it was test equipment calibrated to standards from the Bureau of National Standards so that they would periodically retrieve the test equipment and recalibrate it. And so they always knew where it was, and then they knew when to go get it. I knew that when they went to get it, it wasn't going to be where it was. I also knew that when this stuff is missing, they fill out reports, and they have to report it, and ultimately agents from the Federal Bureau of Investigation come in to see what the hell happened to the equipment. And I had what is described in the big book, page 30. 31. As a feeling of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. And I called this guy and asked him if he'd take me to an AA meeting. And he said he would. Said, don't drink anymore, because if I was drunk, it couldn't take me. And I drank some more. In fact, I drank enough so that when it was time for him to be there, I had my life problems in much better perspective. I don't know what the hell I'd called him for. And he showed up, and the first thing I told him was I was not an alcoholic. And he said he didn't know if I was an alcoholic or not, but he thought we were going to the right place. And he took me to the Culver City Studio Group, which is my home group, where I was warmly welcome. And where I was telling each person that I wasn't an alcoholic, and each person was saying, well, you're in the right place. And one guy said, and this is the truth about our program, this guy named Charlie. And Charlie is a slipper. I didn't know that at the time. I didn't know we had slippers, but Charlie said that he kept going out and getting drunk, and when he came back, he was always welcome. So he said, you don't have to believe you're an alcoholic to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You don't have to say you're an alcoholic to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. All you have to have is a desire to stop drinking and say you're a member, and you're a member. And he said, your place is here, whether you're here or not, and nobody can take your place in AA. And I believed Charlie, and I thought that was great, and I had a sense of well-being. I thought maybe I was in the right place. And then they read chapter 5. And I knew I was not in the right place. Particularly, it wasn't so bad until they got to that one place where it says, there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. I'm in the wrong place. There's nothing about that that is going to be helpful to me. And I didn't, it wasn't my intention to be cynical. And it wasn't my intention to invalidate stuff. But my mind would just invalidate stuff automatically. Right before they read that about God being all-powerful, they said, remember, we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, and powerful. And I heard that. And then they said God was all-powerful. And I said, well, to myself, well, if God is all-powerful, then he's that power in the alcohol, because all is all. And so that's not bad for a start. Then the further they went, the worst I got. And then they said, do not be discouraged. Way the hell too late. At the meeting, this was a studio group. It's one of the oldest groups on the west side. And this was the beginner's meeting. And if there's somebody there, the first thing they say is, there anybody here in their first or second, after chapter 5, they say, is anybody here in their first or second meeting? And if somebody raised their hand, then the subject for discussion that night are the things in the chapter working with others that it says to discuss with the newcomer when you meet him the first time and the second time. And they discussed it the way that chapter says to discuss it. They defined alcoholics as men and women who have lost the ability to control their drinking. Nothing very strict, but if you drink more than you intend to when you start drinking, and you do that with any regularity at all, this guy said when he discovered he was doing that, then he discovered he was not controlling his drinking. He said control is control. That if you're driving your car to work and you just wreck it 3 times a month, he didn't feel like he would be controlling his driving. I got that. And then he described the characteristics of, or somebody did, the obsession of the mind that somehow, some way, this time it's going to be different. That I will not drink for a while, and the longer I don't drink, the worse it gets. And I'm sure, I know that if I just have a couple of drinks, then I'm going to feel better. And eventually, I'm going to know that if I just have a couple of drinks, that's all I'm going to have. In spite of countless faint attempts to do that, I try it one more time. And then they described the physical reaction to alcohol, which might be an allergy, that manifests itself in the phenomenon of craving for more once they start. Well, I had them there. Couldn't wait till the break. I had them there. I did not ever crave alcohol. After I had a couple of drinks, I would want another one. Bad. But I didn't crave it. I told that to the guy that took me to the meeting at the break. I said, I didn't ever experience a craving. He said, you probably didn't. He said, some alcoholics, when they start to drink, if you just keep slugging them down as fast as you can get your hands on it, the craving don't have an opportunity to set in. Funny thing, I kind of thought maybe I fit in that category. You know, I didn't invalidate that. But if they, you know, but I'm telling you, that was the kind of mind I had. If they said craving, hell, craving didn't mean anything to me. I'd invalidate it. And after the meeting, I told him I was an alcoholic, but AA couldn't help me. And he smiled and asked why, and I told him that I wasn't an atheist, but that I didn't care whether you called it God or a higher power. Higher power was well with me. But that everything that I believe, that everything that exists, exists in accordance with a principle. And that inherent within the principle is unlimited intelligence and power, so that the thing always manifests itself exactly in accordance with the requirements of the principle. And prayer didn't have any part in that, nor would anything intervene to make it different. That my concept of God was that it does not violate its own principle in order to accommodate me and my problem. So AA wasn't going to help me. Kenny smiled and said, that's great. He said, you're not an atheist. He said, atheists come in and get sober. But But he said, it's a lot better if you have a concept of higher power. And he said, Dice, you really have a good one. You're going to be able to help me with that. Then he said, can you not drink? I said, yes, I cannot drink. And he said, well, don't take Denny's either. I hadn't even told him I took Denny's. I don't know how I knew. Unless he noticed that I said the same things over and over and over, real fast. But he said, when you got in my truck to come to the meeting, the first thing you said was, you are not an alcoholic. And he said, when you get in my truck to go home, the first thing you said is, you are an alcoholic, but we can't help you. And I don't expect you to see it at all. But I see that we're already helping you. I had told him that. I said, I just listened. I listened to those steps. And there's nothing in those steps that I'm going to be interested in doing. And he said, I don't expect you to see it, but you've already taken the first half of the first step. So it's already, you know, if you admit you're an alcoholic, that's the first half of the first step. He said, as you go through time, you'll see it. You'll see it more and more. He said, look, you know, don't worry about the God stuff. Let's just go to meeting. And I got drunk one more time, and then I came back with the idea that I was going to AA and I wasn't going to drink anymore. And I went to AA meeting. And I did have a sense that I was doing, you know, that I had some kind of good feeling about going to do this. And I had never laughed uncontrollably in my life until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I heard some of you guys talk. And of course, it's identification, you know, one drunk talking to another. And it is, you know, just spontaneously when people say things that I've done and they say it in a humorous way, it's funny. And I had smoked pot 3 times in my life, and I was not a great pot smoker. I was a great paranoid, but not a great pot smoker. But this guy, Huey McFarland, I heard him talk when I first got sober, and Huey McFarland was as alcoholic as you come, but he had smoked pot a couple of times with some musicians. And he said the good thing that he discovered about smoking pot was that you didn't have to talk because you knew what they were thinking. Now, I had just smoked pot 3 times, but I knew what he meant. Then he talked about taking Benny's when he was in the Army and thinking, God damn, these guys march slow. I heard Flo D was a wonderful lady. Physically, she was not a knockout. She was, you know, she jokingly talked about getting her brassiere on backwards and nobody noticed it, you know, including her. But she also described herself as a man chaser, you know. She said she chased her first husband in the church and caught him by the organ. She said it surprised her so much when her third husband proposed to her that she fell out of bed. And she talked, and among this humor, she talked about the help she had gotten to recover from this seemingly hopeless state in mind and body. And she talked about difficulties that she had encountered. First, they talked about helping people on Skid Row. And she's helped a ton of people on Skid Row. She died in 1973. And I was talking down at on a panel at the Drifters in downtown Los Angeles, and I mentioned Flo Diddy. And a guy came up that that was down on the streets then, and he just lives in a cheap hotel. That's his home. He's sober, been sober a long time, and he remembered Flo Diddy helping him get sober. So, but anyway, she was a great lady, and she talked about getting the shingles, and talked about, at the same time, she fell and broke her arm, and she was in great pain. She couldn't sleep. And she was sitting on the edge of her bed at 3 o'clock in the morning, and she lost patience with God. And she shook her fist in his face and said, "Why me?" She said a booming voice came to her and said, "Because, Flo, there's something about you that pisses me off." Now, hell, I had heard that before, but it wasn't funny when I heard it before, and it was funny when Flo told it. And it helped me. It helped me not just love Flo, because, you see, her colorfulness somehow let me feel more at home. And the fact that her God would say he was pissed off made her God more attractive to me. You see, you got to be sick for that to help you. But we don't come in well, you know. And that helped me. That kind of stuff helped me. I'll tell you something else that helped me. You know, it happened to me my first night, and I didn't know it. One of the principles that was somehow discovered in this program that isn't just, you know, that I don't experience other places. I didn't experience in school. I didn't experience it at work. And that is, nobody has ever tried to invalidate me in Alcoholics Anonymous. Regardless of how the dumb thing I say, like that first night when I was telling everybody, you know, nobody said, "You're just full of it, boy, you're an alcoholic." Very clear you're an alcoholic. Kenny knew I was an alcoholic, for Christ's sake. He had seen me drink. You know, he did say that everybody that he knew that my life was in total trouble. He said he wasn't going to tell those people that I was coming to AA because he wanted them to think I wanted to stay screwed up. And I said, "That's right, but don't tell him." But he never, you know, I got validated here. All my life, people had told me what was wrong with me and what I needed to do to correct it. And I didn't realize it, but my character, you know, a fundamental characteristic of my personality was, if you told me what was wrong with me, I hated you. And it didn't make any difference if I knew that what you said was true before you said it. As soon as you told me what was wrong with me, I hated you and I denied that what you said was true. True story, when I was young, I saw a gray cat and misspoke myself and said it was a purple cat. Somebody called me on it, and I was willing to fight that it was a purple cat. Hell, I knew it was a gray cat, but I wasn't about to be wrong. You know, just goddamn. You know, I came to AA, and nobody's ever started telling me what's wrong with me. But Norm Alpie, first time I heard him talk, I was less than a month sober, and Norm stood up there and described himself as the vice president and general manager of the Midnight Auto Supply in the San Gabriel Valley. He was a car thief. He said that he didn't come to AA as a giver. He came as a taker. He said, "I was a taker of things and a user of people. I was a loser. All takers are losers, and you're looking at one right here." And when Norm said that, I was thinking, I'm just like Norm. You know, he was talking about stealing cars. I'm just like Norm. Hell, I'm stealing stuff, you know. I'm a taker of things and a user of people. And before Norm got through with his talk, he was on the sunny side of the street. And he was going to go home to this little red-headed ass woman that he had married. And she was going to be glad to see him. And he talked about walking his daughters down the aisle so that they could marry these jackasses that they married. And buying them prom dresses and high-heeled shoes. And when I left the meeting after hearing Norm, I knew that I was a taker of things and a user of people, and I'm doing the deal, and it's going to work out all right. You know? And then I'd wake up the next morning and have another rotten day. And then I'd come back to an AA meeting, and I'd get put back together. And I didn't know that was happening to me. But that's what happened to you, and that's why when you're new, you don't have to understand this. The important thing is to do it. Just come to the meeting. And we hear stuff that is presented in a way that was presented. I heard stuff that changed my life. And when I would first hear some of this stuff, I'd invalidate it. Archie Johnson said that success is getting what you want, but happiness is wanting what you're getting. And whatever you're getting in the moment, like that, because that's what's going to happen anyway. And if it's something that's adverse, do your best to like that, because that's, you see, if you don't like it, that adds to the problem. Now, that makes a lot of sense to me later on, but when I first heard it, I thought, well, let's jab Archie in the eye with a sharp stick to see how he likes that, you know? I would automatically invalidate this, you know. But later on, you see, this stuff keeps working on you. You know, and later on, it made sense to me. It made sense to me that instead of me hating the rain, to love the rain. You know, to love it, because it's going to rain anyway. The only trouble you can have with that is when it stops raining, then you got to have an attitude adjustment and love the sunshine, you know? But anyway, I heard a lot of these things, and just gradually my life changed. And I became convinced to work the steps. Not because I analyzed my problems and thought the steps applied to my problems. I took the equipment back. My sponsor tracked down that equipment I'd stolen. Just tell you, he did that. And my wife and I borrowed the money and bought the equipment and took it back to the company I stole it from. And I tell you, the next day, the weight of the world was off my back. And I would have argued that it didn't bother me. I did argue the day before that it didn't bother me, and but I took it back, and the next day I felt wonderful. I just woke up and I realized that, man, that had been taken care of. And that was a great experience. And so these things happened. And a guy said, if you're, you know, one morning I had decided I'm not going to go to meetings anymore. AA don't work, because I had a problem. I had pushed the lawnmower into a tree root and had hurt my chest on the handle. My automatic response was I was mad at my wife and at AA. If AA worked, would my chest hurt? No. I didn't have to think about that. That was automatic. And anyway, that night he said, if you're new in AA and you're not working the steps, AA will stop being fun and you'll decide you're not going to go to the meeting. You don't go to the meeting for a while and then you'll go to the bar and order a drink. And if you do that, and the bartender says, what's the matter? I thought you was going to AA. Don't AA work? But if you haven't worked the steps and you're not working them, be honest with the bartender and tell him you don't know if AA works or not because you didn't try AA. And there was nothing in me that invalidated that. That was one that just fit me, and I made a commitment to work the steps. And I had wonderful experiences about working the steps. I did a fourth step. I saw that my dad wasn't my problem. I honest to God saw my I saw that my problem is I'm angry, I'm resentful, I'm afraid, I'm dishonest, I'm selfish. So, you know, and in the face of adversity, that's the way I am. And that's my problem, and that's what causes my problem. I don't know what the hell I'm going to do about it, but I see that, and I do a fifth step, and a sixth step, a seventh step, and on down the line, and I start changing. And I know, guys, I had changed some for a long, long time, but one day I was in the face of a problem, I started laughing. It struck me funny. And a problem had never struck me funny before, and I started laughing, and then I was laughing because I was laughing. And then it dawned on me that I've changed. And I've changed because I'm working the steps, because I'm in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And right then, looking back at it, I came to believe that I have found something that really works for my goodness in my life. I'll never have to take a drink again as long as I live if I don't want to and I keep doing this stuff. And that's where it's been ever since. And now I have a rich life. And in this process, somehow, I have been able to see the goodness in my life. See the goodness in my life. There's a place, I've never had to put a priority on any problem. I do not have, in my thinking, problems get automatic high priority. And I have had to learn through the program and through prayer and meditation to put a priority on seeing the goodness. And that has worked wonderfully for me. So I can see the goodness, I experience the goodness, I have a good life. And a major, major, major part of the goodness is the friends I have in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have many in this room. And one of my very best friends isn't here. He's up saving souls in Vancouver, Canada. But his kids took me out to dinner tonight, and I'm grateful to them and all the friendships that I have here. And thank you very much for letting me share.
Okay. Have a short question and answer period.
I'm going to start talking again if somebody don't ask a question, so you aren't going to get out early. Yes, sir. Please talk loud because I'm... Okay.
Tell me what it was like when you let go of some of your expectations on other people. And when was that as far as your sobriety?
When in my sobriety did I start to let go of my expectations of other people? And how did that come about? Just talk about that. And I will tell you that has diminished. One of the times I went to lunch with a guy named Frank Giroux. Frank asked me what was wrong, and it ended up that I told him that my life was like a guy that was spinning plates on the tops of sticks. That when he got the first one, I don't know if you've ever seen these jugglers or not, but I explained this to him. And I said, he gets that fourth plate going, and the first one starts to fall, and he has to go back, and he's doing all this, and he gets the fifth one going. And I said, Frank, that's the way my whole goddamn life is. And Frank waited about this long to say, well, Howard, why don't you let the plates fall? And I said, that's easy for you to say because you're retired and I have to make a living. And he said, you're an engineer. He said, what you're doing isn't living. But he said, you're an engineer, and you know that what keeps the plate spinning is centrifugal force that's put into it with the guy's hand and the law of gravity and a rim on the plate that allows the thing to spin there. All of the anxiety, all of the tension, all of the energy that you put into it in order to make it do what you want it to has nothing to do with it. It's God's law of gravity and centrifugal force that keeps things moving. He said you have to do the footwork. You have to do the footwork, which is put the energy into the thing, but all of the expectations, all the demands that you impose on your life restrict you, rob your life of goodness, and have no part in having the things work out. And he said they'll always work out. The footwork just puts you in a place where you can experience them working out. That helped me let go. That helped me let go, and that has helped continue, you know, ever since then. That has been a part of my program, is that I can just relax and not try to, through stress and strain, impose myself so that my demands are met. There are a lot of other examples, but that's my first one. Is that it? I have 5 minutes more. Is that it?